Hi, everyone. This is your host, Martin Willis, and today is episode 2 with Bill Burns of UFO Hunters, UFO Magazine. This is an interactive site. We have an option on our website, which is podcastufo.com. You can go to the top menu bar and look at the interact. You can email an upcoming guest or actually set up a phone conversation or Skype while we are recording with our guests. Thank you for listening. We are now on Stitcher, and here is episode 2. I have Bill Burns on the line. How you doing, Bill?
I'm good. Thank you for having me, and happy holidays, everyone.
Yeah, thank you. And I've recently got into watching all of the UFO Hunters. Very fascinating. I think you did a great job with that.
Thank you.
And we can talk about that right now. Later on, we'll talk about UFO Magazine. But if that's okay with you.
That's fine. Go ahead, and it's your interview.
Yeah, okay. That show looks like it was a blast to do. And it seemed like you had carte blanche to do about anything you wanted to as far as following leads and things like that. When you had to do an episode and there was a lot of travel involved, did you have to pitch like each episode to the production company?
Well, it was really a combination. Essentially, Nancy, my wife Nancy, who's the editor-in-chief of UFO Magazine, did a lot of the research for the show with the show's senior producer for the production company. And so that set up the background for the various episodes. But there were instances where events would happen, like the Stephenville lights in Texas in late 2007, early 2008, and the National Press Club conference in Washington, D.C. that Leslie Kane and James Fox held in November 2007. And these were special episodes that we did. We basically changed our entire schedule to do these. And yes, in that particular case, we had to pitch the production company. The production company had to pitch the network because those were major changes in the schedules. But they went along with it because they knew these were breaking stories.
Right, right. And I know I watched that, let's see, it was called Alien Harvest, where the cattle, you know, unexplained slaughters were and things like that.
That was an especially tricky episode to film for a whole bunch of reasons, having to do more with logistics than anything else. But we had basically a fresh kill, a fresh mutilation on this one rancher's ranch, and it was a matter of getting there as quickly as we could because we wanted to get there before anything happened to the carcass. We wanted to do some chemical tests on it and things like that. So we didn't get there exactly when we should, but we got there as quickly as we could. It was very difficult to move a crew the size of ours on a moment's notice. We did, but it was very, very tricky to do because there were airline reservations. We obviously had a lot of equipment that had to be that had to be packed. Cameras before you, and the cameras were very expensive. These are network cameras. These weren't little handy cams. They were big Vericam, Panasonic Vericams, with tape decks and monitors attached. So, and they were high definition. So, and they had to be color balanced and balanced for each episode. So the technical logistics were very demanding. Luckily, we had a great crew and a great director of photography, Kevin Graves. But the trick was that you could not move these cameras. You just couldn't swing them around. So every time we finished shooting for the day, the cameras had to be broken down, cleaned,
wow,
and packed. And so you can imagine when we're flying, when we're moving from location to location, the baggage requirements for these airlines, I mean, you're talking about 30-some-odd boxes of equipment. So it was a matter of making sure that the equipment was secure, it was unlimbered, and that everything was broken down and properly packaged, because obviously when the airlines are handling these things, they're handling them not as if you're talking about fragile glass. And of course, the cameras had to fly with us. They actually came on the plane. We never got separated from the two cameras.
Oh, I bet. Now, when you're talking about a crew, how many people are involved in actually going on a location?
Oh, there could be as many as, let's see, you had the three UFO hunters,
right,
three Talon people. Guests would fly in separately. You had Camera A and Camera B operators, and Camera A operator was a DP, the director of photography. You had the segment producer, whether John Greenwald or Kevin Barry or et cetera. Those were our segment producers, Dave Story, Kevin Cummins. And you had Rob Blumenthal was one of them too, Scott Goldie. Then, so you had one of a number of segment producers. Then, in some cases, the story editor, whether it was Stu Chiat, whether it was, I forget the other person's name, but one of the two story producers would usually fly out to a location, and sometimes the senior producer would fly out with us, and then you had our showrunner, and the first season it was Alan Lagarde, and the second and third seasons it was Steve Nigg, and they would always be flying because they were the actual, they were like the Uber directors of the episode. They were in charge of the set and in charge of the shoot, and the segment producer reported to that person. And so when you realize you're flying with, in some cases, 10, 15 people,
wow,
it was a lot. And our sponsor and product placement sponsor was Southwest Airlines. So It was a case of you're not flying, because if you notice, when we filmed in a jetliner or we're at an airport filming something, it was always Southwest. And so we basically flew with journalism passes, because we were journalists. We were credentialed journalists. We flew with journalism passes from Southwest, which meant we had to be there 3 hours in advance, and then we would get assigned seats when we got there.
Okay, just one more technical part on the show I wanted to ask you, and then we'll get right into other things. How long did it take you to film an average episode? And I'm talking about, say, just your average one with several locations.
Usually it took between 4 to 6 days to film an entire episode, because we would film something like 35 hours of video, 20 to 35 hours of video, depending upon the episode, for something like 48 minutes of broadcast television.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so you can imagine what the overhead was in terms of video, and you can imagine what the overhead was in terms of time, and the overhead was in terms of editing and post-production.
Yeah, there's a lot that goes into it that people don't realize. Now, moving on here, there are innumerable things that can't be explained about this whole phenomenon, and I'm one of the believers that the extraterrestrial presence is real and here. One of the things I liked about your show is that you showed kind of both sides. You had like a skeptic's view, or at least you were trying to make a scientific look at something.
Well, depending upon the season, in the first two seasons, Ted Ackworth was
right,
the scientist, and he was, obviously, he was a skeptic. And he was a skeptic not because he was debunking things. He was a skeptic because his obvious function, I mean, Ted Ackworth was at MIT. He had worked for NASA, and his attitude was, look, if you're saying that you've got some extraordinary opinions here about events that defy what we would say are normal physics, if you've got that, you'd better come up with extraordinary proof to back it up. And so he was our conscience on the show.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then seasons, you had, what was the other?
Well, in our third season, we had Kevin Cook, who was an engineer.
That's right, yeah.
And Kevin Cook's attitude was, look, I'm a diehard skeptic.
Yeah.
He said, I will always look for a conventional explanation. He was also, interestingly enough, Kevin Cook, which we didn't stress enough in the show, I think we should have stressed it more because that would have really made more sense when Kevin was doing his interviews and he was giving his opinions. It would have made more sense in retrospect. Kevin was a stage magician. And so Kevin's whole thing was he would, you know, perform at parties, perform on stage, perform in clubs. And his attitude was he was always working with illusions. And he would do card tricks and sleight of hand. And, you know, he was a basic stage magician like any other magician. But his attitude was, look, there is always a conventional explanation for things. And so his job was to find the conventional explanation for things that looked magical.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was his take on it. And so, as I said, it would have been great to really have spent more time with Kevin as a magician, because it would have been fun to have him show why things that seemed supernatural were really sleight of hand and tricks of the eye. So that would have been, upon retrospect, I would have done that more.
Yes, I think that's a great idea. Yes, I have a friend that's a very good magician, and he does things. I just can't explain how he does those things, and it's pretty amazing.
Right, exactly. I think the best scholar of that, if you want to talk about scholarship, is James Randi, the Amazing Randi, who, a magicians obviously don't explain their tricks. That's part of the code of being a stage magician, that you don't explain your tricks. But James Randi's attitude always was, look, there are conventional explanations, and most stage magicians follow in the tradition of a James Randi who's been obviously on stage since the 1950s, and most of them follow in that tradition of you don't explain your tricks, but you make it absolutely clear these are illusions. This is entertainment. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of the code of this, you know?
Right. When you had the episode on NASA and you showed an explanation of the footage where they were showing the 12-mile tether.
Right.
That was actually fascinating how they showed how that explained how that came to be. Now, were there other things that you can think of off the top of your head where things could be explained during the show?
Most of the anomalies in the NASA videos could be explained conventionally.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were I think the two big issues in the NASA, well, there are actually three big issues in the NASA videos. And I think probably the two best scholars, three best scholars, would be Bruce McAbee, Dr. Bruce McAbee, who's an optical physicist for the Navy, now he's retired, and Professor Jack Hasher. I forget what university he's attached to, but Jack Hasher worked for NASA as a physicist, and Jim Dilatoso, who's a photography expert. And the issues when you're dealing with NASA videos, I mean, the three big issues would be, first of all, that the NASA cameras on board, let's just take the space shuttle, for example. I mean, there are other issues, but there are other missions, right? But let's take the space shuttle, for example. The cameras on the space shuttle, especially those in the cargo bay and the remote cameras looking out into space, those cameras were remote controlled, and they were also automatic. And in some cases, the cameras would focus on something that seemed interesting because they had their own programming. Mm-hmm. And when they did, many times they would overfocus. And that's the explanation for the tether. There are a lot of dust particles and motes in space. And when you have a camera ultra magnifying these things, that's why on the tether video, all the round circles looked like donuts.
Right.
And they all had this groove. And they were all moving randomly, it looked like, on this huge line. What was happening was that the camera had focused on the tether, which had broken, and it had overfocused. And in overfocusing, it goes into a defocus mode. And once it's in a defocus mode, there's a complete distortion in the sizes of the objects. And that's what happened. That's why you saw these huge dust particles that looked like flying saucers, but in effect they were tiny particles of dust. And so when you and also you're shooting through panes of glass, which distort right. objects far away. And that was the experiment we did. So there was the fact that the cameras on the shuttle were overfocusing. Two, the shuttle was moving. So many, and the shuttle would rotate. So many times when you saw an object seeming to do strange things, what you're really looking at is the shuttle itself moving and the camera trying to stay stable on an object while the craft itself is in motion. It's rotating. Hmm. And it would rotate to try and get a fix on the object.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So that would explain some of the motion. And the third big thing is you're looking at a two-dimensional frame of a three-dimensional landscape. That's really important because what you're not seeing is objects going into the distance that look like they're going somewhere else. So imagine imposing two dimensions on three dimensions. Hmm. You're going to lose that third dimension unless you understand that you're looking at things. So for example, in one of the videos, it looks like an object is heading in one direction, an anomalous object, which is actually rotating around the curvature of the Earth. But you wouldn't know that because it's a flattened projection of a three-dimensional frame.
Hmm. I see.
So when you look at those three issues, that could explain 95% of all the anomalies that you see in NASA.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. To move on here, I do historical research for work. I really enjoy what I do. So my favorite episode was the Lost UFO Files with James McDonald's papers.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that was great overall. And what would you consider your favorite episode?
Well, that was one of them. I mean, my favorite episodes through the years were, on the one hand, the Area 51 episode, which mm-hmm. was the last episode of Season 2, which really got some of the highest ratings in History Channel's history. The Dulce episode from Season 3 because of that stunning discovery of that photograph of this hybrid fetus that was taken from a mutilated cow.
Right, yeah.
The Aurora airship mystery from Season 2 because we actually solved the problem. We figured out what it was. And so those are my favorites. I mean, I did love the Stephenville episode from Season 1 and the... We didn't really shoot an episode at the National Press Club conference, but we used that. Oh, the other one was, of course, Bentwaters, mainly
yes.
because we debunked the debunkers. And so there are various reasons for each of the episodes. You know, the reason I really liked the Stephenville episode in Texas was that we got there literally while it was happening. And there are certain moments in those episodes that are really exciting to me. One was... the video that I forget her last name. I want to say it's Valdez, but I'm confusing it. It was this video that this woman took on a nighttime camera in her backyard because something was stealing her little game animals, her chickens and her ducks and things like that. And she caught this beam of light, is an infrared beam of light coming down from the sky and not touching the ground, but kind of scanning. And then we saw that video, which was pretty compelling, but then we had another witness who chose not to be identified, but another witness who saw a craft over a railroad trestle outside of Stephenville shooting that same kind of beam down on the ground. And both the eyewitness and the video seem to corroborate each other. So that was a really good piece of video evidence. Obviously, mm-hmm. Area 51, we caught a UFO on camera. So, I mean, you know, that's the holy grail of this. And the holy grail would be catching
sure.
an alien, but it was the holy grail. Then the reason, and those were two episodes where we actually got some really great video. Then in Bentwaters, the exciting thing was, at least for us, that we took on the major debunker arguments. We did that in Bentwaters, and we did that in the Aurora, Texas episodes, one from Season 1, one from Season 2. And in the Bentwaters episode, what we took on was the fact that you had this person, Vincent Thurkettle, who was the local forester, saying, oh, the whole thing was a bunch of hogwash and nothing was really happening. He gave a bunch of explanations that made absolutely no sense.
The lighthouse, which, right?
Yeah. Well, the lighthouse was something else. That was, we can get to that. But, these are all rabbit scrapings. And, of course, when you go to the Bentwaters base, when you go to the old RAF Bentwaters, what you see are actual rabbit scrapings. You know what rabbits do when you go out to the forest. In Rendlesham, what he was calling rabbit scrapings were not. I mean, it was there were two different things. And then he admitted that he'd been spoken to by plainclothes investigators, obviously from either British military intelligence or from another agency. And they really instructed him into what as to what he should say to people who asked him. So that was one. And so there was a debunking going on. And the other one was, of course, the whole lighthouse story, where people like Ian Redpath and others had argued, oh, all these idiot U.S. Air Force people saw was the lighthouse. But, of course, these were people who'd been on the base, who'd seen the lighthouse, who knew about the lighthouse. And they knew where the beam was from the lighthouse in the forest because they could see it. They could see it from the end of the runways. These were Air Force personnel who saw the lighthouse every night. So why would they confuse the lighthouse on one particular night? So we did two things in that episode, which were great, both scientific. One was scientific. We actually brought our effects producer, John Tyndall, out to Rendlesham Forest. And we did waypoints on where the different sightings were, GPS waypoints. And then we reduced them to a scale, built a model of the area. And when we displayed the lighthouse flashing and the places where the Air Force personnel, particularly Colonel Holt, saw the light from the object, what he described as the object and the reflection on the windows of the farmhouse, you could see from the scale diagram based on GPS positions that the lighthouse was in a totally different place. So they couldn't possibly have mistaken the lighthouse for the object. And more importantly, the lighthouse would not have illuminated the windows in the farmhouse. I mean, it was basically CSI stuff, crime scene forensics. When you recreate it, you know that they couldn't have possibly seen the lighthouse. Then we went to interview Seaman, who was the lighthouse keeper, who explained to us that because there was a metal plate over the lighthouse when it when the light rotated over the land, you could not see the beam from the lighthouse in Rendlesham at the clearing because it was blocked by a metal plate.
Wow.
Wow, so, I mean, it was debunking the debunkers. And then I love crimes. That's what I loved most about the show, with the crime scene analysis stuff we did. That was the best.
I think that's then, great, yeah.
Yeah, so that was Bentwaters. Then the other was Aurora, Texas. Again, debunking the debunkers. There were those who argued that there never was a crash in Aurora. There never was a well. There never was a well pump that was hit. And, of course, we got permission from the landowner to use a backhoe and a front loader to lift the pump house off its foundation, set it aside, and we dug, and sure enough, we found the well, we found the well pump, we found everything that the story said existed was there. So that was debunking the whole debunker about there was no well. We went into the well, found pieces of aluminum, found aluminum in the ground, found aluminum in the trees, and sure enough, what we figured out was this was aluminum. We tested it at the University of North Texas, and when we tested it, we found out that this was aluminum, but the alloy came from before World War II.
Wow.
So it was from the very beginning when aluminum was being used. This was not the aluminum you see today. It was a different alloy. So now we could date the aluminum to the first half of the 20th century, at the very least. Then we went to the historical records, and sure enough, in the historical records, we had a historian, Sarah Kennedy, I forget how she pronounced her name. It's spelled Kennedy, but it's actually pronounced Kennedy. Sarah Kennedy, she pulled all the historical records from the 1890s. And sure enough, in the 1890s, this airship mystery was 1897. In the 1890s, there were these metal-clad lighter-than-air ships, because lighter-than-air ships, small balloons, small dirigibles, were flying throughout the American Southwest from the 1860s on. The mm-hmm. first use of surveillance aircraft came at the Civil War, when President Lincoln right. was shown a balloon that could be used as surveillance aircraft, and both the Confederacy and the Union used balloons as surveillance devices. Napoleon used balloons as surveillance devices in the early part of the 19th century. So this was a common military craft.
Right, hydrogen they used.
Yeah. Right. Well, in the 1890s, a lot of these balloon sportsmen figured they would take their balloons over to Cuba to help fight the Spanish-American War. Right, and so one of the balloons crashed in Stephenville right around the time of the Aurora mystery. It came down for a crash landing because its gasoline engine, its internal combustion engine, wasn't working properly, and the guy had to land. Well, the next day or the next couple of days, that's when it hit the windmill of the well pump and exploded, and the hydrogen exploded, and that explained all the metal flying everywhere. And of course, it was hydrogen that was and the pilot mm-hmm. was incinerated, and his remains, we've actually found through ground penetrating radar his remains in the cemetery.
Wow.
So we explained it. The UFO now became a balloon. It's no yep. longer a mystery.
Yeah. Wow. We have an email question that on our website. We're interactive, and we had one email sent from a fan of your show and of you, and here it is right here. There was a rumor that UFO hunters were getting the public too aware of what was going on with the UFOs and was inadvertently and quietly shut down by the government. Is there any truth to this, or was it rating based? Thank you, a very big fan, Thomas. End of quote.
Well, it wasn't really rating based, because the ratings were very high. We were beating
That's what I thought. Yeah.
Yeah, we were beating the Housewives shows on Bravo. We were beating the Daily Show on Comedy Channel. So our ratings were incredible. Anybody wanted to go back to some of the old episodes, when you see the sponsors for those episodes, Mercedes, IBM, Apple Computer, Porsche, I mean, these were major sponsors. Mm-hmm. So the network was doing well. There were two reasons that were problematic for us. One, very conventionally, were budgets. I mean, the show was budgeted at almost $350,000 per broadcast hour, and that was way out of line with history. Another mm-hmm. reason was history was changing. Reality television was changing from, let's say, 2006, when the show was first greenlighted, to 2009, when it went off the air. And the show, if you look at the difference between season one and season three, you could see a major difference in how the show was assembled. And in that third season, what the network wanted was more organic interplay among the UFO hunters themselves. I'll call them characters, right? That's what they wanted. If you look at season two, it was a completely different show. Ted, Pat, and I would go off in different directions. And that was when you mentioned the McDonald's. That was mm-hmm. the classic example of that. It was the Lost Files of James McDonald, where Ted investigated one thing, right?
Right.
Ted investigated the RB-47 case.
Mm-hmm.
Which was something McDonald was really fascinated by.
This is where that 700-mile trip that was... Yes.
Exactly, mm-hmm. and then shadowed by a craft, and the craft was... It would ping on radar in one spot, then suddenly move to another part of the plane, and it was freaking out the crew of the RB-47, which was our most advanced surveillance aircraft at the time. I mean, when you consider this was a B-47 bomber, this is before the B-52s came online, so it was a B-47 bomber, but it was a reconnaissance B-47. And so the premise of this craft was to scrub electronic transmissions and all kinds of radar signals from over a theater, a target area, and relay those and log those. And so it was intelligence gathering plane. Well, here was a case where you had it picked up a craft, and it could skin paint. In other words, it was getting a radar bounce off the craft, right? Then suddenly the radar bounce would disappear, but the craft was still there. And so what the crew couldn't figure out was, at a time before stealth technology, how a craft could cloak itself electronically. Now we can do that. But, I mean, that was something that back in the early 1950s and late 1940s really couldn't be done, at least with our technology. And this craft shadowed the RB-47 as if it was keeping track of our own technology, something we do today and the Soviets would do to us and we do to the Chinese and the Soviets during the Cold War. So, and we still do it today. So that was behaving as we do to our quote-unquote hostile assets, right? Hostile craft. So that was one. And that was TEDS, since that was technology, that was TEDS, right? Pat Uskert was off on a different story entirely. And I was off on the story of the Rex Heflin photos.
Right.
Which were some of the best UFO photos. Those and Paul Trent were some of the, from 1952 in McMinnville. Those were some of the best photos ever taken. And the Rex Heflin story, at least for me, you know, we had a choice. I mean, Ted wanted the technology, Pat wanted his story, and I wanted the Heflin photos. One, because I knew Ann Druffel, who was McDonald's biographer. And the story of McDonald himself goes to a large extent, almost proves inversely that the government was trying to hide something. On the one hand, it was all the efforts some kind of agency made to abscond with the Heflin photos, then to debunk Heflin. Then McDonald himself was not a believer. He was not supporting the Heflin photos for a bunch of reasons until scientific evidence showed that Heflin was absolutely correct when you looked at how a Polaroid camera adjusted for light. Remember, Polaroid cameras in the 1960s, and that's what he was shooting with, the Polaroid. And it was not a heavy-duty, you know, like, pro camera. This was a, you know, he was just shooting road signs and things like that. He was he worked for the Orange County Road Department. The Polaroid camera adjusted for light. So he's shooting from inside his pickup truck. So the pickup truck cab itself was adjusting the ambient light coming into the lens, which is why you saw bright light on the one hand and then hazy light on the other, which Heflin couldn't account for. And then, of course, when they duplicated that, they showed that he could account for it, and, you know, because that last smoke ring photo.
And when he stepped outside of the vehicle.
When he stepped outside of the vehicle, suddenly the camera didn't have to adjust, right? For the light, it didn't have to open up the lens to get more light, hence the whole background sky changed.
Right, yeah.
So there was that. Then there was who took the photos, the original photos, took them away, et cetera, et cetera, then brought them back. And it was the strange events when this group came, when these people came and said they were Air Force or NORAD, whatever, and wanted the photos to analyze, and there was this purple haze inside the car, and Heflin's hi-fi system went staticky. I mean, this is all weird stuff. And so... but the science of it was the fascinating thing for me, because we had Terrence Masson, who was our photo expert, and Ted Ackworth, who was our metric expert, physics metrics. And the three of us sat down and went over the military's analysis of the photo. And so the military created a set of completely false algorithms to say that Heflin had thrown a hubcap up in the air and then photographed it.
Right.
I mean, Howie would have done that, you know, from inside his truck, but let's leave that aside. That's what they said he did. And they said he did it by, and they could tell that because of the distortion of the size of the object against the background road, against the light, against a light pole in the distance. And they gave an algorithm to explain why that was all distorted, and hence the photo was faked. What we did was that we went back to the original algorithm that the military used and used our own frame by frame and created an image based on the metrics that the military provided. So we used their own figures. Then we imposed those figures and we created a black and white image based solely on those figures. The pole is this high, the object is this size, right? Mm-hmm. Then we overlaid those algorithms on the actual photo itself. And of course, what we proved is that the military was wrong. Mm. They were debunking by hoaxing their own math.
Wow.
And we love them, and it happens. And this is why I kind of take that episode, that McDonald's segment, and align that with the Bentwater segment to show, and then the Gulf Breeze segment from season 3, and show here's a case where the debunkers actually hoaxed the data to prove their own point.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. Hey, one of the things I thought of, was there ever any time when you were filming or during the episodes or during the show seasons that you felt uncomfortable, like you were in any type of danger or anything like that? Did that ever happen?
In Dulce and at Dugway. Dugway season 3, Dulce in season 3, both in season 3. By the time we got to season 3, after the Area 51 episode, where at least one person from a three-letter agency told us we were in a lot of trouble. We had made people in certain government agencies very mad at us because we actually lugged that three. Or remember, we were the first ones on camera to show a close-up photo of Area 51. That was
one thing
we did. Yeah, mm-hmm. That was the Dulce episode. I think it was episode... I believe it was episode 213, the last episode of season 2. We showed a close-up of this huge hangar, and then we overlaid that photo with a Google Earth shot, a satellite map, and showed why were they building this huge hangar. Well, I'm sure the Chinese and the Russians already knew about that hangar, but people really mad. So that was one. We knew we were in trouble. And so by the time we went to season 3, we were being tracked because
really?
We would show up at a place and people would be there to meet us who wouldn't have known we were going there.
Wow.
So that was that. And that was mainly at Dugway by the time we reached the end of the show at episode 313, which was the Dugway episode, where police came out to greet us and kind of they wanted mm-hmm. to confiscate our cameras and our videos and stuff. And we, you know, we talked our way out of it. I said, what did you guys want? And, you know, we're on public land. We're not on military land. You really have no authority here. No, we're not going to give you our cameras. Yes, we have shooting permits. Here they are. Go away. And then the person said, oh, you have to talk to the public relations officer at the base. I said, I'd love to talk to, you know, bring the person out. Let's get this rolling. So she came out and we got her on camera. And
right.
I thought that was a fabulous, you know, that's one of the things that happens when you're shooting live and you get a guest like the public information officer at Dugway, one of the most secret bases in the military. And it was a secret base ever since the 1940s when we were testing nerve gas to be used against the Japanese. Remember, in World War II, we were getting set to deploy nerve gas against the Japanese, and the Japanese were deploying biological weapons against us. So we were already playing with weapons of mass destruction before we used nuclear weapons against Japan. So that was one little secret that I don't think people knew about. And to find out that at the Dugway Proving Grounds, not only were they testing invisibility cloaking devices, because we had witnesses telling us that, not only did the witnesses account for underground tunnels, because they were seeing trucks disappear into the ground, but we were surveilled by a black helicopter that were looking at us very carefully. And that's on camera. You know, they filmed us, we filmed them. And then people in guard huts were popping out to see us, and we filmed them as well. So there was a lot going on at Dugway, in addition to the PIO coming out and telling us that there were defense contractors working at Dugway. So it was really exciting at Dugway. But we knew the series was over at that point, so we really kind of decided to, you know, just to swing for the fences.
Yeah.
that was Dugway. But in Dulce, we were in a spot where there were strange hybrid animals running around, these little creatures running around. One member of our crew saw one in his hotel room, and the crew began to freak out at the anomalies in Dulce, and that never got on camera.
Wow. Wow, that's interesting.
And then,
the person saw this in the hotel room? What?
These were shadow people that the tribal leaders of a Jicarilla Apache were talking about. And we didn't know what they were. We wanted to stay and film them. The network said, no, get out of there. And because we could have gotten them on camera. But they were things that literally would have been, would have really broken open the egg, so to speak, had we got them on camera. There were these shadow people that the Apache talked about. They knew where they were. They knew where they were playing. And somehow they were part and parcel of the reservation. And other tribal police officers were telling us about these hybrid animals, foxes with the heads of rabbits, and these strange caravans of black vans leaving the Archuleta Mesa area, going to Albuquerque. What was in those vans, we didn't know. We could have spent a lot of time there. Just another week filming all night long to catch these vans as they were leaving, because we knew what the schedules were when these vans would leave the Mesa. So there was all that stuff. Whether the Mesa was still an active base or not, we didn't know, because our guides were afraid to actually take us to the vents going into the mountain. You could hear the noises. I think the base is basically closed down. I think we were looking at more history than we were active stuff, but there were still hybrid animals running around there. This was really a strange place. Then, of course, we showed the photo of the hybrid animal, and that kind of sealed our doom, because I don't think that it had anything to do with extraterrestrials. I think, in fact, we were told point blank, you stepped right into the big pharmaceutical industry engaging in animal-human hybridization for the purpose of creating personalized organs for the military. You know, somebody gets shot, needs a bone graft, somebody, you know, heart valve goes, what are you going to use? If there were a way to use your DNA and stem cells cloned with those of a pig or a cow to and culture it, to grow it, and there would be a stockpile of organs. So if you were among the 1%, so to speak, not the 99%, but the 1%, and you could basically have your own organ bank, this was a way to do it. This was an experiment in that. And it so aroused people that after the episode aired, Senators Lindsey Graham, Mitch McConnell, all been in the news recently, right? McConnell, Graham, Grassley introduced a bill that would amend Title 18, federal Title 18, which is the Federal Criminal Law Act. Title 18 are federal crimes. And it added something to Title 18 saying that it would be a criminal offense to interbreed humans and animals, even at a DNA level. So you couldn't hybridize humans and animals. It was a cross species. It prohibited cross species fertilization. Well, I mean, we knew at that point that this was serious stuff. I mean, when you are stepping into somebody else's money, and in this case, mm-hmm. big pharmaceutical money, you know, your days are numbered.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. You're playing with the big boys.
Right. Yeah, and so if they were working with if they were working with the military, I mean, that was kind of an unholy alliance. I mean, you could understand the rationale for it, but I mean, in all fairness, if they're trying to keep the secret, and you know, and there are these three guys who are looking for flying saucers, and suddenly come across this, and this was based on a fetus taken from a mutilated cow outside.
I saw
of,
that. It was scary,
and,
very scary.
You know, that's that. Yeah. You know, you've basically blown a whistle.
Right, right. Just one more question on the UFO hunters, and it's a two-part question, and then we'll move on a little bit. If you were to take on the show today, would you? Is there anything in particular that you would like to shoot an episode on, and or is there anything you would change about how you did the show?
Well, I would build up more of. I would try to go younger. I would try to really limit the use of graybeards in terms of the, including myself, in the use of experts. I would try to be more current. Mm-hmm. I would try to have more of going to hot spots. I would have much more science. I would really rely heavily on science, and I would really, and I would do episodes like on the Red Rain, for example, that are alien spores. Nobody knows what they are. I would go back to Dulce and spend some quality time in Dulce. I would do longer episodes, just in terms of filming, and try and get more stuff on camera. And there are places where there are real anomalies going on today. I would try and go there. And I would try and actually find more evidence of UFO crashes. I would spend more time in Kansas, for example, try to interview the witnesses in Delphos, Kansas, and places like that. There were episodes that I would really try and go into much deeper, like the Val Johnson episode, the Delphos, Kansas case, things like that. I would spend less time on alien abduction.
Yep.
And more time on physical evidence, because I think that the science is far more compelling in some cases than the anecdotes.
Right. Now, did you happen to see the image on, there's several shots of it on YouTube, of the UFO over the dome in Jerusalem?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah,
you know,
what did you think?
I don't know. I mean, there were two schools of thought. One is it's a complete hoax because they were looking at the way the frames worked, the backgrounds worked, the object against the background, and other people saying, oh no, there are other videos from different positions. So I would really, if we were taking that on, I would actually go to Israel, go to Jerusalem, do some filming, interview the live witnesses, and just basically have a scientific, you know, he said, she said, over the actual videos and spend more time with the videos.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great answer. Let's talk about your magazine. Can you explain to our listeners in detail about your magazine?
Well, UFO Magazine has been around since 1986. It was one of the earliest magazines ever to devote itself exclusively to the UFO phenomenon as opposed to the paranormal phenomenon, which is far more inclusive. I mean, Fate's an older magazine going back to the 1940s. And then there were others like Flying Saucer magazine from the early 1950s, but we were, you know, which really grew out of the whole Flying Saucer cult of the early 50s. But we were the first one in the 1980s to really take on the subject from a scientific as well as a kind of new age spiritual approach.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Has while you've had this magazine, have you uncovered anything like through an article or anything that really sparked a lot of controversy?
Well, yeah, our current issue, for example, has an article about by someone who claimed to be a participant. He claims to be, and the reason I'm saying claims is that I never saw an ID, showing him a member of that organization, a non-official cover officer in the CIA, and said he'd been dispatched by a non-government organization, an NGO, working on behalf of a government agency, probably the Department of Defense, to this NGO, this group, call it a committee, if for want of a better term, didn't really call itself anything, was investigating the historical aspects of the UFO phenomenon and would give out contracts to various academics doing field research on anomalous events in ancient sites. And this one professor that they had funded went to Egypt, was exploring the pyramids and the Sphinx and things like that, and did come across an object that was an anomalous object. It was kind of a DVD or a CD. I never saw it myself, in an odd shape. And instead of giving it back to the group that had funded his expedition, he basically absconded with it, stole it, and was selling it to the highest bidder. In this case, it was the French. Well, the committee, as I said, had contacts within various contracts with intelligence agencies. And this one writer, call him Agent X, John Augustine, was given the assignment. It was called the black bag job of going out there and retrieving the article and making sure this person who saw it disappeared. And that's exactly what he did. And he tells the story in this issue, this current issue of UFO Magazine. And one of the things that he reveals is the person who showed up to take possession of that object, that disc, was a Father Malachi Martin, who everybody knows in the Amityville Horror case. And he was working for the government in the area of UFOs, and he shows up. And this guy was astonished to see him. Whoa, Father Martin. And sure enough, Father Martin was working in U.S. intelligence agencies.
Wow. Wow. So if someone would like to pick up one of your magazines, you can go to your website. Can you give the URL for that, please?
Sure. Anybody wanting either a single copy or a free sample, you can get a free sample of the magazine, not the current issue, but a back issue, a free sample of the magazine. Right now, we're the stack of samples that we're giving out are, which I think is another great story from, also from season three, I love this story. It was the Star Child episode, this anomalous skull, the skeleton of this 4.5 foot, 4 foot creature, humanoid, that this young teenager discovered all the way back in the early part of the 20th century in a cave in northern Mexico. And it went, the possession of this skull, it was part of the skeleton, but the skeleton, you know, the rest of it was lost. But this skull was given from owner to owner, wound up in the hands of these relatively wealthy people, who gave it to this neonatal nurse to evaluate. And the neonatal nurse, I mean, a neonatal nurse, her job is, or his job is, to be able to account for various anomalies in the skull of a newborn baby, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they thought this was, oh, poor child had hydroencephaly, you know, water on the brain, basically, and that expanded the kid's skull, and that's why the kid... No, first of all, it wasn't a baby. It was not a five-year-old child. It was an older entity, whatever it was, and it certainly did not have any hydroencephaly because the skull was perfectly symmetrical, not asymmetrical, the way an encephalitic skull is. The sutures were in the right place, that had formed perfectly, and then she gave it to Lloyd Pye, who studies cryptozoology, and Lloyd Pye found other anomalies in it. For example, the eye sockets were all wrong, where the neck bone, where the vertebra went into the base of the skull, that was all wrong for human beings. The skull had to be pitched at a whole different angle for it to be able to see. That made no sense. Then the density of the skull was different. It was a much harder bone material. And so that story's in UFO Magazine, and that's the sample that we're giving out.
Great.
Until that runs out, and then there's something else.
Yep. Okay. Just one more question. What sparked your interest in UFOs in the very beginning?
Well, I mean, I had a sighting all the way back when I was a little kid living in New York City. Oh. And then mm-hmm. you kind of bury that thing and say, well, I had a sighting, so what? And then I was hired as a literary agent and an editor to work with Philip Corso on the book that later became Day After Roswell, which I wrote with him. And the folks from UFO Magazine that was in financial trouble at the time approached me to, again, as an agent, to kind of broker a deal with the motion picture company that had hired me as an agent to represent Philip Corso's book to mainstream publishers, which I did, and published it. And they were looking to for a buyout or some kind of buy-in. And the movie company did, and then they realized 5 years later they didn't want to be in the magazine business. It was draining too much from their core business. And so they turned it over to me, and that's how I wound up being the publisher. My wife, Nancy, is the editor-in-chief. She's had magazine experience all the way back since the time she was in her 20s. So, you know, that's what we did. We worked with the founders, Vicky and Vicky Ecker, who's the founder, and then her husband Don Ecker, who came aboard later, and then they went their separate ways. And that's how I got involved in, you know, in the subject. Mm-hmm. And then from that, the History Channel approached me to do be a guest expert with authors that we worked with in the magazine and in our ebook company, to do the old UFO file show, which I did for like 3 years. And then from that show evolved UFO Hunters, and from UFO Hunters evolved Ancient Aliens, and then America's Book of Secrets. And so I've been on History Channel really for 8 years now, representing the magazine. And so that's how I got involved in that. And the magazine website, for folks who want to pay us a visit, is ufomag.com. That's ufomag.com. Pay us a visit. You'll see a place on the website where you can click through to get a free sample. Click through, get a sample. We send you the magazine. All you pay for is the postage, because that's an out-of-pocket expense. So for $2.50 postage, you get your magazine by first-class mail. If you like it, subscription information is inside.
Fair enough. Great. Anyway, thanks so much. You've been absolutely fascinating, and it's been such a pleasure to talk to you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. Have a nice holiday to everybody.
And this is Martin Willis with Bill Burns, and we're signing off.